Oi, oi, it's your boy, the Kai Kara France of Shut Up and Dance. Jack Snack, it's the Jack Snack podcast, and we're coming at you, well, it's the boycast, actually, we're coming at you ahead of UFC 305. Where the hell's the hype? What's going on? I'm pretty online, probably more than I should be, more than I would like to admit. I'm in circles where the algorithm will feed me this shit, and I've seen barely anything. I'm getting what people used to get about Bellator, where they'd go, why didn't I know there was a Bellator happening this weekend? And Bellator defenders would go, well, you need to be looking. You need to be checking on Tapology if there's a Bellator. You need to get the Wikipedia up and check list of upcoming Bellator events, and you need to write it down in your paper diary. And then you need to check that before the weekend. But I'm having that with this card. There's been, like, no mention of it. The only thing that I've seen to hype it has been Israel Adesanya putting up a photo comparing their dick sizes in their weigh-in photos. And the other stuff has been, like, Israel Adesanya talking about Francis Ngannou and how you can't erase his history, which has been a weird thing this week. They've been claiming that Tafon Ngchukwu's the first Cameroonian MMA fighter and or first Cameroonian UFC fighter. And Francis Ngannou fired back, no, it isn't even me, it's Sokoju. It was just like, what did Sokoju do to upset you? But yes, that's the only other thing I've seen about this fight. And I think it's probably partly because people don't know what to make of it. Partly this disbelief that Dricus du Plessis is the champion still. Partly Izzy fatigue, which we were getting towards the end of Izzy's title reign anyway, or people were. Partly the UFC being focused on other things like Power Slap again for some reason. The UFC's back out, Dana White's back out on podcasts talking about Power Slap, and someone did what you're not supposed to do, which is tell Dana what Power Slap is to his face. This dude on a podcast just said, well, I watch it, and then one guy hits the other, and then the next fight's exactly the same, and then the next one after that. And Dana White, instead of saying, like, oh, hang on, there's a bit more to it than that or whatever, said, well, you could say that about fighting, which is just, no, don't do that. The more I see of Dana, the more I'm absolutely convinced that he's lost the juice. You know, it's like how Donald Trump has sort of, like, failed to make up good nicknames for a while. You just know he doesn't have it anymore. I don't know if Dana was ever a great promoter anyway, but you know that he doesn't believe that Power Slap is a good product. You know, he wouldn't choose to watch Power Slap. He wouldn't go for a night out watching Power Slap. He doesn't, you know, flyweight MMA. You could watch him watching the main event of his cards, and he'll have Canelo up on the laptop instead. There's, like, multiple times that's been photographed from ringside. I suspect he's still a boxing fan more than anything, but he is a fight fan, so he knows that this is shite, this Power Slap stuff, but he's still out there and he has to promote it. And it just comes across as desperate every time. You know, it's just sad. What I wouldn't give for, like, a Don King-style flim-flam man right now. But yes, we'll briefly look down this card. We'll talk about Craig Jones Invitational and Abu Dhabi Combat Club, which I wrote an article about Craig Jones Invitational, which you can check out on the Patreon, also on the Fight Primer for free. Craig shared it on his Instagram, which was really nice of him. 24-carat boy, that's that fella. But yeah, I always separate the fighter from the person. And I, you know, it's how I can enjoy Mike Tyson knowing that he's a convicted rapist and all those other things. But it is quite admirable what Craig Jones is doing with the Craig Jones Invitational. Not like painting him out to be a hero or anything. I'm sure he's as deeply flawed as the rest of us, but there is something good going on there, which I would like to applaud today. So we'll talk about that later. Very rare that you get to talk positively about the people involved in combat sports. But let's talk about this card. UFC 305, Dricus du Plessis versus Israel Adesanya. It's an odd one, and it all hinges on this fact that, like, has Izzy lost a step? I think a lot of people think he has. I haven't seen stats about his activity, but in my view of things, his activity seems to have fallen off quite a lot in recent years. But then I'm also comparing that to his kickboxing days, because when I first saw him in Glory, and if you go back and watch those first fights with Pereira, you know, Pereira's a scary dude. But Izzy doesn't care. Izzy's throwing, like, he's throwing a strike a second. It's incredible. I understand that in MMA you have to worry about the takedowns, and that probably hampered him somewhat. A lot of it is going to, it's where you fall on the Sean Strickland stuff. And I am not an enjoyer of Sean Strickland. I have enjoyed him, like, going after Tiki Ghosh this week, whatever his name is, this week, and saying, this is just what I heard about a rape accusation. He's like, it's not slander, it's not libel, I'm just saying what I've heard. You're going, like, okay, well, if it's true, fuck Tiki. But also, I think that can fall under slander or libel. I'm not entirely sure. But then that's, you know, I always say allegedly after most things that I talk about. Or if I have something really bad to say about a boxer that I know personally, I'll just send it to Carl McLaughlin instead. I'll be like, I need to moan at someone about this. But yes, it comes down to whether you think Sean Strickland caught Israel Adesanya being lazy or unprepared or riding the high of the Alex Pereira win. Because that's the way people achieve their biggest achievement in combat sports. And then the next fight, when they're like right back to normal, when really, when you're a world champion, everyone who comes to fight you is like preparing like you just did for the biggest achievement of your career. So it happens quite a lot. Guys will go up in weight in boxing, they'll win a fight there, and then they'll take an easier opponent the next time and lose. Quote unquote easier. But I think a lot of it has to do with the styles, the stylistic matchup, the constant crowding of Sean Strickland, but also like Israel Adesanya, all his punching, with the exception of that big left hook, which is quite wide, and it got him dropped in that fight with Sean Strickland. But most of his stuff is straight down the line. Doesn't punch the body much. He does go to the body, but with kicks and knees and things. Actually, just those two things. But, you know, the two things that really made a difference for Alex Pereira were like the body jab setting up the big left hook, leaping forward. And the left hook is a great weapon against Sean Strickland because it comes around the side of him while he's reaching. Every time he reaches forward with his right hand, which he did constantly against Israel Adesanya, the whole right side of his jaw is exposed. And the body jab did a great job of pulling that hand forward and not letting him. If you throw it like Pereira does, it's very long and it's hard for him to get back at you, which is what he counts on when you're throwing punches at him. He likes to get back at you with a jab of his own. Pereira landed a couple of low kicks, but Izzy was looking for low kicks the whole fight, and Sean was actually looking really good at checking them. You know, he fights on one leg a lot of the time, so he's very good at getting a leg up and minimizing the damage. And his front kicks to the body were wonderful in that fight. Probably one of the most important teeping performances in MMA history from Sean Strickland. You can go and read How Sean Strickland Killed the King to get my full gushing report of that. But I think a lot of it was stylistic. I think, you know, I'm ready for Israel. I'm ready for Israel Adesanya to come out and smoke DDP in this one. But I would be very surprised if Israel Adesanya took a rematch with Sean Strickland and said like, oh, I've got everything locked in. I'm taking this more seriously than every other fight I have in my life. I'd be surprised if he just blew Strickland out of the water. I think he's always going to have a hard time with Strickland because Strickland's set up to deal with straight punches down the line, throwing his straight punches back and crowding you. And Izzy doesn't like being crowded and he throws straight punches down the line. And that's the sort of stuff that Sean palms quite easily. Plus, you know, once he's picking up his legs and you're trying to kick him in the legs and then he's on top of you, jabbing you on one leg. It's an awkward style that can be exploited in a lot of ways, but weirdly, like one of the more adaptable fighters or strikers in MMA couldn't adapt to it. But Dricus du Plessis obviously is not Sean Strickland. There was a great clip of him going around this week saying, yeah, people watch my fights and they say, oh, look, Dricus is putting his foot here, he's putting his foot there, and I'm not thinking about any of that. I think I went Aussie at the end there, or Kiwi, but he's talking about people like breaking apart the footage of his fights and saying what a clever tactical thing he did. And I don't know, I follow a lot of people who do break down stuff on Twitter, and I am one of those people who likes to point out technical stuff. But I don't think I've ever said anything like that about Dricus, and I don't think I've read anything like that about Dricus. He makes some good reads on people before the fight, like the southpaw jab against Robert Whittaker. He said it would work, and it did. And honestly, that's why I have to trust him having the game plan every time going forward. But no one is ever like praising his mechanics, thinking he does anything clever like that. Like, he is a messy, messy fighter. But as we talked about with Rob Whittaker, mechanics aren't everything. Mechanics are the stuff that someone can teach you in the gym and work over and over again, and you can improve on them, and they will keep you safer. Safer. But they won't keep you safe. You can be an absolute mess, but if you can watch an opponent's footage and say, right, I see that there, and time the right stuff, you're going to take them apart. It doesn't matter if you're mechanics are all over the place. I mean, you might get chinned on the way, but if there's one thing we know about Dricus du Plessis, he takes an amazing shot, and that makes up for defense quite a lot. The reason that a lot of people would not bet on Dricus du Plessis ever is that when you rely on a big chin, it will fail at some point. It's just dropping single straws onto a camel's back constantly, and then eventually one of them will break it, but hasn't happened yet. It's kind of like the Diazes. I used to say they will get knocked out at some point, but I wouldn't build my game plan around being the first guy to do it. I would be digging to the body, kicking the legs, doing the clever stuff. And then if you knock them down with a punch on the chin, that's great. But some people are just made out of granite. I suspect the wrestling will be a large part of Drickus's game plan, because even when he was doing well on the feet against Robert Whittaker, it was a part of his game plan. It was a part of his game plan against Darren Till. It was a part of his game plan against Sean Strickland. It was the, well, whether you believe he won it or not, it was what made the difference in the fight with Sean Strickland on the judges' scorecards. Yeah, it's an odd one because he's a very strong, physically strong wrestler. He's a very awkward grappler, doing things like toesy passing. Toesy passed Robert Whittaker in an MMA fight. Crazy. But he still sort of like runs, lunging in after people, ducking his head down to try and get the shot. But then he took down Strickland, and Strickland's got very good takedown defense. But then he had a really scrambly match with Till, who's terrible on the ground. So it's just, he's a complete agent of chaos. But then as a guy who works on bullshit techniques and likes to surprise people, that's close to my heart. I wonder if Drickus can succeed where Vettori and Whittaker had successes. Whittaker using the double jab and actually getting into range with Izzy. You know, the first fight, he was lunging from across the cage, doing these big sprints on a straight line. If Izzy stepped out of the way, he just carried on past, just the momentum of running forwards. And if Izzy let him fall short and countered him, or just let him run onto hooks and things, he got really badly hurt. Rematch, he's playing a lot more, it's a more conservative performance, but you can tell he's not as scared, because the running to get people, that ultra aggression, that reckless aggression, is normally out of discomfort and fear of, like, what's going to happen when I close the distance? Better charge him down. And Whittaker did a lot better in the rematch, just getting close to Adesanya, double jabbing, raising the knee, throwing things away to get close to Adesanya without offering up his chin for free. And Vettori did decently with I think it was the double jab again, but like just crowding Izzy to the fence and then shooting a bad double and not being able to finish it. Izzy very good at holding himself up, but that's it. Like, if Drickus is good at taking people down along the fence and he's massive and strong, maybe double jabbing in towards the fence and doing that is what he wants to do. If you want to actually land on Israel Adesanya, double jabbing him towards the fence or faking and feinting him towards the fence and then throwing low kicks as he's circling along the cage, that's the way to get him. But you don't be seeing anyone do that, because that's the thing. The great thing about being a decently elusive fighter is that the moment that people get you in a position where they can hit you, they go for the knockout. They go, oh my God, I've got him near the cage. I'm swanging at that head. And Izzy goes, all right, I'm going to duck under that. And then you're out the side. All the pressure's dissipated. They've got to do all that work to get you back near the cage again. Whereas if you just like let them circle and kick the leg, you get a really good connection on the leg. You slow them down a bit. And then, oh, wow, look at that. You're now able to corner them more because they're losing a bit of their mobility. And of course, if you land a good low kick on the trailing leg as someone's circling along the cage, you pick up that leg by kicking it. And if you just step in and start punching, you've got a good chance of landing some stuff anyway. Same shit I say every time, really. I mean, I'm interested to see if Drickus feeds his chin onto a good counter, because Izzy's game has not always been like counter-centric. At his best as a kickboxer in a lot of his fights, it's like inside low kick, step back into southpaw. If they come forward, you throw the left straight. If they don't, you throw the left high kick or the left front kick to the body. Sometimes if they step in, he throws the left knee. It's a lot of being orthodox to get on southpaw. And then if he fights orthodox, it's that thing where you put your right hand forward as like a parry and a catch, like Roy Jones used to do. So it squares your shoulders. And then you can throw a right low kick from a shortened position because you've got yourself halfway there. Or you can throw a jab that's been coiled by you turning your shoulders square. So by standing there with your right hand out like you're about to, I don't know, run your fingers down the guy's chest. Now, by having your right hand out ahead of you like that, you put some power on your jab and you take some power off your right low kick, but so that it can be thrown about the same time, you know, about the same speed as your jab. So it's a really nice little thing. Sadiq Yusuf, the boy, if he's listening to this, he did it in his Contender Series fight. God, remember when they were good guys on the Contender Series? Actually, I did watch the Contender Series this week and it was fine. Just fucking Gianni reminding me that if you're watching it, you're a degenerate, because Gianni's going like, if you bet on him landing more than 50 strikes this round, it's like, you know, you're just making everyone aware that everyone who watches this, except me, obviously, is a giant loser. But anyway, odd fight. Interested to see if Izzy can take Drickus out with... If Izzy can take out Drizzy with some counters as he comes in. The knee to the body, I think, could be a big one for him. Because Drickus is so tough, I want to see him. It's another one of those fights where you want to see both guys get into the body for different reasons. I want to see Drickus get to the body to do adjudicative damage and slow Izzy's footwork down. I want to see Izzy go to the body because Drickus has an iron head and to slow him down with that. Because obviously, like, Drickus runs around with his mouth open the whole time, does get more reckless as the fight goes on, but still put on a great pace against Strickland in the 25-minute fight they had. So hammer that body with knees. If you find that you're landing good counters and you're not knocking him out, you've got to do what Corey Sandhagen did against Song Yudong and say, fine, I'm going to cut you open. Because if you get him running onto elbows, firstly, it's more sturdy. He's going to hurt himself more. You're not going to hurt your hands on his. Because believe it or not, people do hurt their hands on some of these guys' heads. If you've got someone with a great chin and you're throwing as hard as you can, you will very quickly fuck up your fingers, even through gloves and wraps. So landing elbows, and then you've got the investment in the cuts. If you can cut him open with elbows, that looks great. I mean, it was a huge part of the debate over the Strickland Duplessis scorecards. Like, one of them got cut and everyone was going, oh, the value of the blood, blah, blah, blah. I think that's enough about that fight. This is it. It's one of those fights where I really am interested in it. But I don't know if I can make that interesting to you. It's like a lot of Drickus Duplessis fights where I'm looking at it and going, oh, okay, well, let's see what big Drickus can bring to this. So that's all I got for you on that. It was that or do an emergency history pod on the scramble for Africa. Let's put these comments in their correct context. Oh, no, I haven't. I don't even remember what he said the first time. And I just said, I'm not listening to any of this. I'm not getting dragged into this. We're moving on. If you want to call me back when you're talking about dick size, well, I'll give you my analyst's eye for that. But no, I'm not doing the real African shit or whatever that was. Co-main is Steve Ersig versus Kai Kara-France. I really like that fight. Ersig, great all-rounder, great technician, Mr. Technico. Even against Pantoja on the bottom, he was hitting little knee levers, gigglers, whatever we're calling them. I call them gigglers because I do them and then I go, hee hee hee, as the opponent comes back and I try an arm drag and fail. But at least I got them off balance for a second and them to go, oh. But yeah, despite his like two knockouts on his record, really good striking too. His boxing's very crisp, got a great left hook, which is something that still isn't very common in MMA. Kai Kara-France, obviously much more, much less offensive as a grappler, does not pursue takedowns and things like Ersig does. Much more a guy who knows what he's good at and gears his game around staying in that area of the fight. And I think that Kai Kara-France's striking style, even as a guy who wants to like specialize in the striking in MMA and keep the fight standing generally, his striking is more in that anti-wrestler sort of style. If you watch his fights with like Askarov and Moreno and Bonturin even, like he's showing fakes, he's using his jab well, but it is a very stiff jab. And then he's throwing big wide uppercuts and things. He's throwing things that he wants the opponent to see. You know, if you duck your head and you dive in recklessly, I'm going to take it off with this uppercut. But he's doing big uppercuts to set up jabs and things. And that's real sort of anti-wrestler stuff. You don't need to do that against a guy who's going to stand with you. But it's been forever since he fought, because he fought Amir Albazi. Do you remember that dude? Talked a ton of smack after he headlined a fucking card. Do you remember that? Tail end of last year? Won the split decision that was supposed to be his coming out party and everyone just went, huh, okay, well, that's one guy in the top five that Pantoja hasn't fought, but we don't care. We'll continue having Pantoja fight the guys that he's 9-0 against. Mandatory at this point in the podcast for me to go, do you know what? I don't think anyone knows how good Pantoja is or notes how good he is. So I like that fight. I think Ersig, I think there's a couple of options here. I think that you could try and use your wrestling offensively, which I would expect Kai Kara-France to expect, and also he trains for constantly. So I would be interested to see if Ersig can crowd him towards the fence and make some boxing exchanges that are a bit longer, catch Kai looping his punches, take advantage of having that great left hook and the good head movement. You are taking risks because Kara-France is probably the bigger puncher. But if you can fluster him and get him out of position, I could see Ersig dropping him with the left hook or the right hand, actually. He's got a pretty good right hand. And by doing that, by pressuring him and striking instead of ducking for a takedown immediately when you get him near the fence, you don't get the takedown early, but you do improve your chances of getting the takedown later when you've got Kai Kara France going, right, we're in a boxing match and I'm fighting for my life here, or I'm fighting to not get chinned. But again, by being the all-rounder, he's also got another advantage where if Kai Kara France is throwing out kicks, you just drape your hand over the kick and pretend you're going to run through it. Suddenly, he's not going to kick as much. So it's a good fight. I still think Kai Kara France is more dangerous, as in, like, stop the fight. I want to get off. No, stop the fight, as in he can land a big punch and just turn that into something else. But I think Usyk, if he can stay safe and avoid getting chinned, probably going to win rounds. Gamrot versus Hooker, real interesting test because like Dan Hooker doesn't really have that many fights against good wrestlers. I'm thinking about like his fight against Mark Jacquesi back in the day. He made Jacquesi, who was a striker at the time, try and take him down, and he was hitting these, or you know, he was getting guillotines and sweeping him off them, and then eventually got the guillotine later in the fight. But every time Jacquesi ducked in, he grabbed his neck. He's got the good knees that stop people trying to take him down. But again, like trying to think of people who did try to take him down, and you know, he didn't catch them coming in. Obviously Makhachev, but you know, even the Chandler fight, Chandler wasn't in boring Chandler hump him along the fence mode. He was in I'm going to run in swinging mode. How much grappling did he do against Dustin? I can't remember. But yeah, Matuta Gamrot is going to be diving on his legs all over the place. And where Gamrot has come up short in the past, actually he did struggle with Jalen Turner, but it's that like guys with good balance, Fiziev, Sarukian, because his finishes all involve like getting a single and lifting up as high as possible. And those guys have great balance. And also like Sarukin's got crazy flexibility. So is Fiziev. They're hopping backwards and taking their leg off his shoulder. Dan Hooker's a lot taller than him. So maybe that's, you know, trying to lift his leg up as high as possible isn't going to be as effective. But I don't know if Dan Hooker's as scrambly as them. And I don't know if he's got that balance. But if Dan wants to stand like long and low and shoot out jabs, I suspect he can probably get Gamrot into a boxing match with him, because Gamrot loves to just throw ones and twos off both stances, the odd rear leg body kick. I'd say for Dan, don't throw a fucking low kick until you're absolutely certain that you're going to get away with it, because that's how he got taken down effortlessly by Islam Makhachev. So we didn't even really see like his takedown defense against Makhachev. It was, oh, here's a kick. Oh no, I'm on my back. But yeah, you could just say like, fuck head, you know, head, hands, hips is the three lines. Fuck hips, I'm putting my hands low, because I know Gamrot be shooting at some point. And I'm shooting the jab from there. Because he's got height, he's got reach. You know, you could bring out the front kicks to the body as the fight progresses. I would be very cautious about front kicks in round one. And, you know, especially because it's Gamrot, and if you lose one round, it'll somehow go down as 29-28 for him on the cards. That's his superpower, winning fights that he hasn't. Right, whistle stop tour of the rest of this card, because I want to talk briefly about CJI and ADCC. They got Jesus Aguilar back. Ricky Glenn against Kenan Song at welterweight, which is not his weight class at all. Alex Reyes, Herbert Burns. Some of this stuff is just like, we're supposed to be saving all this stuff for the pay-per-views now. And these people are just not, this does not excite me. Luana Santos versus Casey O'Neill. Ricardo Ramos versus Josh Koulibaly. Okay, right, we're the Josh Koulibaly boys now. No, we're both these lads. Great chance of this being a sneaky banger. Love it. Great chance of Ricardo Ramos doing dumb shit again and not living up to his potential. Junior Tapper versus Volta Valka. Great villain name, mate, but no idea who you are. Oh, Xingliang Li versus Carlos Prates. I like that. Carlos Prates, one of three fighters to have scored a knockout since the new gloves came in. Great front kick to the body against Charles Radke in the last fight. And then was it an Anita body finish up? But yeah, he stunned him winded him with a front kick to the body, which was gorgeous. Kept holding his lead hand too, like literally holding his wrist, which I love in 4 ounce gloves. Just grab their wrist. If they're keeping their hand out there and it's not nailed to their head, grab a hold of it and start pulling it around. But he's on like an 8-fight winning streak, maybe 10-fight winning streak. He has a knockout win over a Charles Oliveira, to which I say the Charles Oliveira, a Charles Oliveira. But yeah, he's really fun. He's fighting Xingliang, and Xingliang has been a longtime member of the UFC welterweight division. He's coming off a loss by split decision to Danny Rodriguez. God, that was ages ago, that Daniel Rodriguez fight. How has the Leech not fought in that long? That's been like 2 years. Oh, fucking hell, spine injury. Ooh. But the Leech, sometimes he surprises you with his striking against other strikers, like his fight against Well, he beat Muslim Salikov recently, but his fight against... I only beat Ponzi on the feet too, but Ponzi's completely washed. His fight against Zaleski was the one that really surprised me. Not much of a takedown artist. Decent at defending a takedown, except when they're really good. You know, their cams out and you come out and throw a right hand immediately. But I think that'll be a fun fight. And Jing Liang's tough too. So if he's going to... lagging on the feet, if he's not quick enough, he's going to take a beating before he goes out of there. Right, CJI, ADCC, I presume you've all read the article that I wrote, which is it has an audio track, and the audio track is 20 minutes, and I don't pause for the GIFs either. So, man, there's a lot to read there. This event is happening because ADCC has prize money of $10,000 to each winner at the male divisions, $5,000 for each winner at the women's divisions. They do have a $50,000 prize for the winner at the absolute, but if you're in the 66 kilos division and you're going, you know, how are you going to win the absolute? I'm going to preface this by saying that I love ADCC. I think it's one of my favorite things that happens in all sports, and them keeping it every 2 years has really helped. I think it was 2001, 2002, they switched over to a biennial, is that the one? Biennial system. It used to be every year, 1998, 1999, 2000, so on. But making it every 2 years, it really does have that feel of like whatever the tournament in Mortal Kombat is, the World Warrior Tournament, the King of Iron Fist, all that stuff. We're all getting together every 2 years and we're going to find out who's the best. And with the rise of Gordon Ryan and the Danaher Death Squad, you know, we got people interested in grappling now, the rise of Nogi. You don't have to care about the gi, which is so boring to watch. But ADCC, with their very low prize money, it's run by Mo Jassim, who did the Modolfo camps, which were great. He filmed, basically, he got a load of great guys over to roll, and he filmed it all. So you can watch Gordon Ryan rolling with all sorts of other people, except for Kanan Duarte, who refused to let the footage be released. And then fought at over 99 kilos in 2019 to avoid Gordon, and then went down to under 99 kilos when Gordon went up in 2022. I've never seen a more obvious case of ducking in my life. But anyway, the thing was always like, sorry, you want money. We don't have any. Which, even if it's true, because it is funded by a sheikh and stuff, they are selling rash guards and all sorts of other shit. I see people, there was a street fight where one guy was wearing an ADCC t-shirt, went viral a little while ago. Mo Jassim will go and say, we are a non-profit organization. To which the answer is, you're booking the T-Mobile Arena, the one that had Maymac and Canelo versus Triple G1. You know, you can go and look up the price of trying to book that arena, or just ask for an estimate. You could book a slightly smaller arena, knock $100,000 off that and give more money to the winners of the divisions, but they don't. So Craig Jones found someone, not sure who, everyone reckons Zuckerberg, but apparently it's not, with more money than they needed. And he said, okay, two tournaments, over 80 and under 80. So very, very rough if you're like a under 66 guy in ADCC, but them's the breaks, I'm afraid. $1 million prize for each. Every competitor gets $10,001 purse, which is hilarious because one, it's petty. Two, it's fantastic marketing because everyone sees how petty that is and says, lol, have a look at this. And three, it makes a great point about like how, you know, if you've got a couple of million going into the tournament or going into planning an event, it's not a lot to give people a purse. Now, granted, there are more competitors at ADCC, but if you're doing an invitational, cut down the number of competitors and pay them. That being said, don't want ADCC to fail. I want to watch ADCC this year, and I'm going to have great fun watching it. The under 66 division is cooking. Not only have you got the Diego Hayes, Baby Shark, Gabriel Souza, Pato, Owen Jones is new this year. Very funny lad from England. Another English leg locker. Or is he Welsh? I can't remember. But he's British. That's how we claim other people's accomplishments. The under 80 kilo tournament in CGI is the one that I wrote about. Absolutely banging lineup. I ran out of time to finish previewing it because I wrote barely anything about Matthias Denise, who's got a great chance of winning because he's the, not last ADCC, ADCC before, he was the champion in the division above. So if he can make the weight, you know, he's going to be an absolute hoss in that tournament. And of course, I completely forgot until the end of the article that it's in the karate combat pit, and it's on. It's going to be judged subjectively on a 10-9 system. So if he grabs a single leg, which he's very good at, like he's got a great single leg. He's got such a good single leg that he gets the single leg, clears it to one side, and then the year before last, everyone tried to Kani Basami him because he had this single leg. It's like, I'm now looking at that going, well, I won't be doing that with my single leg anymore because that's how you get kneecapped or ACL'd. But he has this great single leg. And if you grab a single leg and you just run at the ramp in the karate combat pit, that ramp is going to trip the dude over. And then you can lay on top of him because getting up from a slant is very, very hard. If you remember from the Yama, and that was a much less severe slant. If you watch Sam Alvey versus Ross, was it Houston? What was his name? No, Ross Levine. Ross Houston's an MMA fighter, sorry. Ross Levine in Karate Combat. Anytime they hit the clinch, Sam Alvey just pushes him backwards and eventually, like, the bottom of the pit clips Levine's heels and he falls over on his bum. So it's great for stopping people running out of the bounds, which people have been doing for years in ADCC. And then they brought in this rule where it's like, continue the scramble outside the mats until the ref stops you. So dudes were getting slammed on wood floors and, like, the guy would jump on their back and start choking them. And they'd be going, ow, my back, I just hit a wood floor. But the pit does clean that up. So it's just whether the pit makes it unbelievably boring. But the over 80 kilo tournament is the one that I didn't talk about. My boy Victor Hugo is in there. You'll know him from writing The Hunchback of Notre Dame and the musical Les Miserables, for which he got royalties from the Paris opening ceremony. But who else is in there? Max Jimenez, giant roidy teenager. He looks about 40, but he's not. Owen Livesey, judoka who throws people but doesn't engage on the ground. They had him booked for a match against Yoel Romero in Polaris. And I was just like, that's going to be terrible. Any match with Yoel Romero is terrible. That would be terrible. Owen Livesey's taking on Muhammad Ali in the first round. Muhammad Ali, absolute brick house of a man, can't deal with leg locks. Another one of those guys. Adam Bradley, really fun. I was watching his trials performances. Hits a ton of waiter sweeps, which you don't see a lot generally, but you definitely don't see them out of men of his size. He's taking on Kyle Baum, who is like the king of EBI escape times. So he hasn't adapted super well into like proper tournaments, but he's decent. He's very online though, and kind of conspiracy pilled. Pat Downey is a wrestler who you'll remember him from getting hilariously knocked out in Bellator, but he's a very good wrestler, very good at throwing people. He's taking on Luke Rockhold, the Luke Rockhold of Luke Rockhold. You know, we're all just rooting for Luke Rockhold to get a win because he's, you know, he's so much more endearing now that he's not the champion. Nicky Rod's in the tournament, obviously. Great body lock passer, good takedowns, great wrestle ups from the bottom. Didn't do great against Victor Hugo when he met him a few months back in a Who's Number One match, because I suspected this at the start. I said Victor Hugo does a lot of like supine guard, laying on his back. And Nicky Rod locks his hands when you sit up. And Nicky Rod couldn't get his, you know, you can wiggle your hands underneath someone when they're sort of flat, but to do it against a giant guy like Victor Hugo, and he seemed to really be struggling with not being the bigger dude as well. So very interested to see where that goes. But if Victor Hugo in the first round has Lucas Kaynard, who we're calling Lucas Kaygard now, because he turned up at the Asia ADCC trials, played a ton of Kaygard, looked fantastic. You know, I love Kaygard. Should have been Breakout Technique of the Year when Roman Dolidze was doing it to everyone, but I forgot to do it. Inacio Santos, I don't know. Pedro Alex, I don't know. Daniel Kirk-Villiet, I don't know. Joao Rocha, I know. He's decent. And William Tackett, older brother of Andrew Tackett. Oh, Felipe Andrews in the tournament. If you want to see cool switches, he's the guy to watch. If you want to see switches that might break your opponent's knee, he's the guy to watch. I can't find the beautiful little highlight someone made of him hitting switches. By switches, I mean like when the guy's on a single or going towards your back, you jam your hand between their legs, turn to face them, and your arm creates like a lever of their arm. You sort of arm lock them over your arm, and they can re-switch, and there was all sorts of other like stuff that goes on there. But Felipe Andrew doesn't stick his hand between the legs. He grabs the back of their armpit with his fingers and just slams their head towards the mat, and it works really well. So yeah, man, that tournament's banging as well. ADCC. The thing with ADCC this year is that they're putting a lot of they think that people care about the super fight. And anyone I know who enjoys ADCC is there for the tournament. Nobody gives a shit about the super fight. So this year they've got Gordon doing two super fights. Last year he did a super fight against Andre Galvao, which no one with a brain cared about. and he was in the tournament, and that was what people were excited for. This year, he's doing two super fights on one day after the other. But it's like, I don't care. I want to see you in the tournament. But Gordon's at the point where he's managed to convince everyone that, like, he's the only thing that sells grappling. So they'll just bend over backwards to do whatever he wants. You know, he does these matches in Who's Number One where he gets an unlimited time limit. And then he just wanks off the dude's neck. It's like, no, bro. You watch him in the tournament in ADCC. He's pulling guard. He's getting under guys. He's heel hooking them immediately. He's considering how he, you know, how quickly he needs to get it done. You watch him in the tournament, the previous tournament against like Lucas Barboza. He's weighing up when points are going to kick in, and then he attacks the back and gets extra points for doing it. And like, you get to watch him thinking and playing the rules and stuff. And these no time limit matches or 90 minute matches or whatever he's doing. He just stands there, normally against a smaller, worse opponent, in the standing position, slapping on collar ties, jerking off their head, and tiring them out. And it's like, it's not entertaining to watch. You're the best grappler in the world, and you are capable of much better than this. But yeah, the real loser from, not loser, sorry, the guy who's losing out the most from this CJI ADCC rivalry thing is Giancarlo Bodoni, who was the big surprise last time round. Absolutely smashed everyone in the 88 kilos category, looked phenomenal. And he was an interesting guy because he'd been with Lucas Lepree, I think. Or Lucas Lech. No, Lucas Lepree. Been competing as a black belt for a while. Went to Danaher. And like, his ADCC run coincided with training with Danaher. So everyone was like, oh, Danaher's got that magic and stuff. Bodoni really is something special. And they just put up a 10-minute round of him and Gordon rolling, which was really good. He's considerably smaller than Gordon, of course. But half the dudes in his division have gone to the CJI for the chance at $1 million. He can't, because he's Gordon's best mate and he trains with Danaher, and both of those guys are so close with Mo Jassim and the ADCC guys that he can't go and earn the million. So he's like being robbed of a life-changing sum of money to win $10,000 in this tournament, which still has some good guys in, like Taylor Perman coming through the European trials, Charles Negromonte coming through the South American trials, and a load of other guys who weren't invited to CJI. But yeah, I do feel for Bodoni, because if he were in that CJI tournament, that would be bonkers. That'd be poggers, fellas. A kid's still saying poggers. And I'm running out of time if I'm going to get this up before the weekend. So I'm going to have to wrap it up soon. Man, I didn't even mention PFL. PFL's got one of the good finals. Oh, no, not finals, playoffs. Is that playoffs? Semi-final? But they got a couple of the good divisions fighting this weekend. Or on Friday, rather, is their light heavyweights and their lightweights. You got Impa Kasangane taking on Conan Silvera's son, who I think he's already beaten up once this year. But Rob Wilkinson versus Yagshimuradov. That could be fun. Mads Benel's on. Jordan Oliver's taking his second professional MMA fight. He took his first in Bellator, and obviously it was Bellator. They get world-class wrestlers and just feed them scrubs. And unless they're Pat Downey, they normally get it right. But Jordan Oliver, man, if you've never seen him wrestle, his single leg is unbelievable. Looks way older than he is, which is good, because you kind of want him to have like a longer MMA career. Danny Sabatella's on the card, unfortunately. But yeah, the sad thing is that Clay Collard, he's got Brent Primus, which is just like, Clay Collard's thing is amazing striking. Or creative striking, works off both stances, great pace, hits the body, kicks the legs, beautiful hands, decent conditioning. If you touch his legs, he will fall over, and that's him done for the rest of the round. And he's fighting Brent Primus, and Brent Primus, man, he's going to do that. He's going to dive straight for a leg. So I saw that, and I was like, well, not watching this week then. And then boxing-wise, there's nothing really going on. I was going to talk about Bud Crawford winning a world title up in weight. I thought that was really, it was a fun fight. It was a back-and-forth fight. It was one of those ones where you got sort of reality-checked, because you think, oh my God, this guy just smoked the other guy at his weight, Errol Spence. What can stop him? He's just going to smoke the people in the division above. It goes up a division, and he basically had the Roberto Duran thing where a few pounds lighter, he was throwing people through the ropes with his punches, goes up a few pounds, meets the top guy there, and he's just not making a dent with his punches. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he still hurt the guy, but like, he did not have the magic power up there. And he's still an amazing boxer, so he did win against a world champion in the weight class above, but it did sort of temper people's expectations on him, because he was talking about going up and fight Canelo, who's considerably heavier than him, and all sorts of other stuff. Now people are like, maybe let's just stay where we are and build a legendary legacy there. Being Roberto Duran is not for everybody. And then there's no kickboxing going on this week. There is a Crush event, but Crush is K1 not being bothered, mate. Or K1 Japan not being bothered, mate. I don't get out of bed unless it's a K1 Grand Prix or Rise. So that'll do it for today. I threw my schedule off by writing a massive article this week. I think it was 3,500 words by the end of it. But I'll be back Monday to chat about everything that happened. There's a lot going on. We've got some fun stuff happening that isn't the UFC next week. And I'm going to write another article next week too, but it'll be shorter so that I don't destroy my plans for the week. I'm your boy, Jack Slag. You're my boy because you're here and you know where to find all my shit. Singing Coolibau to the tune of Suleiman by Neil Diamond. Bless.